Chapter 4 Goon Baiting. Airy Neave, a young man in a frantic hurry, added the finishing touches to his costume. In exchange for a month's supply of Red Cross chocolate, he had obtained a khaki Polish tunic, approximately the same shape as a German uniform, which he painted using scenery paint intended for the backdrop of trees in a theatrical production. A Polish tailor obligingly sewed on dark green cloth epaulettes and silver breast pocket insignia made from tin. Neave added RAF trousers, a Czech forage cap dyed green, white piping, and a cardboard eagle and swastika. The outfit was completed with a pair of jack boots bought from a Polish orderly and a wooden painted bayonet scabbard attached to a cardboard belt. Neave was rushing it. He did not look like a German soldier. He looked like an extra from the chorus of a Gilbert and Sullivan comic opera. The homemade uniform was more pea green than field grey and gave off a faintly luminous sheen under lights. Pat Reed, the escape officer, was not impressed by this outfit, but gave permission for the escape to go ahead. A visiting German worker was bribed with cigarettes into surrendering his brass identity disc. Neave gathered a map of the Swiss border traced on silk, a forged identity card, a little money, and a tiny compass. These were sealed into an object he could not bring himself to name, but described as a mysterious, cigar-shaped container about 2.5 inches long, which fitted snugly into the rectum of the future Conservative MP for Abingdon. This object, known as an arse creeper, would become an indispensable addition to every escape kit, a way to hide valuables from all but the most intrusive searches and an inexhaustible source of scatological humour. On the 23rd of August, a warm night, Neave came on evening parade wearing a British greatcoat over his disguise and a considerable quantity of escape equipment up his bottom. As soon as the roll call ended, the coat was whisked from his back. Neave clapped on the cap, fell in behind the German guard detail, and strode towards the gate in as brisk and military a fashion as the situation allowed. "I have a message for the commandant from Hauptmann Prim," he said, proffering his brass identity disc. The guard let him out of the inner courtyard. Neave strode on, but after barely 20 paces, a loud voice called, "Halt!" He turned. In the full glare of the arc lights, his cap shone like an emerald. In seconds, he was surrounded by guards. The officer in command was livid. "This is an insult to the German army. You will be shot." The Germans appeared offended less by the escape bid than the absurd costume it had been attempted in, which they seemed to regard as an insult to the uniform. Commandant Schmidt himself arrived a few moments later, surveyed this figure from a Christmas pantomime, clad in a burlesque German uniform, and sniffed, "What impertinence! Take him away to the cells." For probably the first time in his life, Neave was an object of derision. Langer was brought up from the town to photograph this strange military elf in his green uniform. The guards came to snigger and gawp, as if at a newly captured animal. The uniform was placed in the museum. At evening roll call, a vastly amused Hauptmann Prim offered up a clunking joke, which was translated into French, Polish, and Dutch. "Gefreiter Corporal Neave is to be sent to the Russian front." Neave could hear the laughter from his cell. The episode left Neave mortified. The battle within Colditz was partly about status and dignity, and he had gifted an easy victory to the Germans, so often the targets of mockery themselves. "I had reduced escaping to a ridiculous farce, a music hall turn," he reflected. And yet, for the 20 seconds between leaving the courtyard and the sentry's shout, he had experienced an exquisite unburdening of the soul, a rush of intense pleasure, and a transitory moment of pure, unalloyed freedom. It was like a drug, and highly addictive, he later wrote. Neave was hooked. When they looked back after the war, Colditz inmates felt a collective obligation to make the experience of imprisonment sound exciting, even fun. There were undoubtedly episodes of high exhilaration and moments of humour, such as Neve's absurdly failed escape. Mostly, however, the life of a prisoner in Colditz was spectacularly, soul-crushingly, and sometimes almost unbearably boring. Unlike prisoners from the other ranks, officers did not even have the distraction of work to take their minds off captivity. There was nothing to do, which meant that most did very little. Some read books or sought to improve or entertain themselves in other ways, including theatrical productions and music concerts. Some, like Reed and Neve, spent every waking hour formulating and refining escape plans, while others played cards, wrote letters, dreamed of home, surreptitiously masturbated, and cooked up new recipes using Red Cross supplies. A disproportionate amount of time was spent thinking about food, one of the few aspects of their lives susceptible to adaptation and invention. The German kitchens at Colditz provided the bulk of prison nourishment, highly variable in both quantity and quality. 1/5 of a loaf of black bread, Roggenbrot, a day, or 5 thin slices, small amounts of sugar, margarine and dripping or fat, which some believe to have come from horses, thin soup at midday, a strictly limited ration of potatoes. This was supplemented by food parcels, which offered more imaginative culinary possibilities. Most men ate together in self-selected messes. Planning and cooking the evening meal became a major preoccupation and an important diversion. Orderlies cooked for the senior officers, but the more junior officers took turns to cook for each other. Eventually, Red Cross parcels came to include such delicacies as peanut butter, rice pudding, chocolates, sausages, Frey Bentos bully beef from Argentina, tinned milk, and cheese. But most supplies were basic. A typical evening meal might consist of a slice of Spam or other tinned meat mashed up with some potatoes, flavoured with a Marmite cube, bulked up with ground biscuits, and then heated in a mess tin. The Hun rations by themselves were quite inadequate. The Red Cross supplies bridged the gap from a nutritional point of view and most certainly saved us from malnutrition, said one ex-prisoner. As the war ground on, the inmates of Colditz would become far better nourished than their captors. The frustration of imprisonment found expression in various ways, most obviously goon baiting, the practice of goading their German captors to a point just short of explosion. The origin of the word goon, a catch-all term for the guards, remains unclear. It may derive from the goney bird, a sailor's nickname for the lumbering, ungainly albatross. The goons were thick-witted characters in the Popeye comic strip. The comedian and war veteran Spike Milligan named his post-war radio comedy The Goon Show. The aim of goon baiting was to make the guards uneasy and baffled, and therefore look foolish. If a goon lost his temper, or lost face, the prisoners scored a small but valuable moral victory. Eggers knew that the prisoners were trying to upset us in every possible way. Pushed too far, however, a guard might resort to violence. Each nation had different methods of irritating the guards. The Poles simply pretended the Germans were not there, and if accidentally touched by a guard, went through an elaborate process of self-cleaning, as if brushed by a leper. The French developed a way of singing on parade, in counterpoint, without moving their lips. Où sont les Allemands dans la merde, quand les y enfonce jusqu'aux oreilles? Where are the Germans? In the shit. Push them down, up to the ears. But the British elevated goon baiting to an art. Many of the officers had been to public school and were well versed in a contest of psychological one-upmanship that was both highly sophisticated and completely puerile. Competitive goon baiting frequently occurred during roll calls and might take the form of catcalling, whistling, loud farting, speaking in English the Germans could not follow, and deliberately interrupting the count so it had to be restarted. More extreme techniques included knitting on parade, cutting their hair in strange shapes, and staring at a German officer's fly buttons until he became self-conscious and felt obliged to check them. The high windows above the courtyard offered opportunities for throwing things at the guards and then ducking back inside without being spotted. Water bombs, snowballs, burning newspapers, and occasionally packets of excrement. The confrontations were usually jocular, but sometimes deliberately threatening. Insubordination could shade into sabotage. Any leftover food from the prisoners was used for pig swill down in the village. On one occasion, this was found to contain broken razor blades. Another technique was simply to behave oddly. Playing imaginary snooker, for example, or walking a non-existent dog. In one celebrated POW prank, prisoners took to pushing small pebbles around the prison yard with their noses. There was no aim to the game other than to destabilize the guards and make them ban a wholly pointless and benign activity, which they did. Clothing was another way to express resistance. Eggers was outraged at the way British officers turned up for morning appel in pyjamas, unshaven, slopping around in clogs and slippers, smoking, reading books, wearing the first assortment of garments that came to hand when they got out of bed. Many were still clad in remnants of the uniforms they had been captured in. The Scots wore kilts. On days of national importance, by contrast, such as the King's birthday, the prisoners made a point of turning out in unrecognisably smart uniforms, with every button and buckle gleaming. Indiscipline was the order of the day, often amounting to plain personal insolence, or at least studied off-handedness, wrote Eggers, who never got over the contrast between the politeness of Cheltenham's citizenry and the extreme rudeness of their compatriots in Colditz. I cannot see that this kind of attitude to us served any purpose beyond allowing prisoners to work off their repressions. Most senior British officers tolerated goon baiting as hijinks and letting off steam, but some, including Padre Platt, saw it as demeaning, infantile behaviour that reinforced the German sense of superiority and gave the authorities an easy excuse to impose collective punishments, such as suspending exercise privileges. The lampooning of the guards was tremendously silly, but it served as a psychological prop, enabling powerless men to humiliate and needle their captors. Guards tended to be older, allowing the younger prisoners to imagine they were back at boarding school, ragging the teachers. Goon baiting released pressure, for anxiety was steadily rising in the sealed confines of Colditz, and cracks were appearing along fault lines of nation, race, and class. The prisoners reacted to the mental and physical trauma of captivity in very different ways. Anger, resistance, and courage, but also despondency, guilt, and acquiescence. Some found ways to amuse and educate themselves. Some kept calm and carried on, discovering a sort of peace in enemy custody. Some became frantic. Some lost their minds. One of many unconscious defence mechanisms was to behave as if there was nothing inherently odd about being locked up in a gloomy medieval castle with hundreds of other bored, predominantly middle-class men. In fact, of course, there was nothing remotely normal about Colditz, a place of isolation without women, work, children, news, money, liberty, or a foreseeable future. After less than a year in existence, Oflag 4C was already one of the strangest places in the world, pervaded by a unique sadness which the men tried to ignore. Sometimes, at night, an eerie lupine howling could be heard rising from the French quarters, a keening, wordless lament picked up by one voice after another, echoing from the windows and reverberating around the castle walls. After these outbursts, the French said, they all felt much better. The indefatigably positive Pat Reed claimed the maxim of the camp should be never a dull moment. But that said more about him than it did about Colditz. A more accurate motto would have been dull in the extreme, but interspersed with moments of extreme excitement and paralysing fear. In August 1941, the Poles organised the first Colditz Olympic Games. Men might be able to survive, at least for a time, without women, pubs, or freedom, but they could not live without sport, a central element of masculine identity then as now, a way to keep fit, but also an opportunity to compete, emote, and bond. There were games of rugby, hockey, boxing, cricket, and an unladylike form of netball. Football was the most popular sport, and competition was fierce. Sport, wrote one prisoner, acted as a balm to utter boredom. Played hard, watched avidly, and then discussed afterwards, endlessly. Whether the prisoners were participating or spectating, sport made the sluggish time pass more quickly. The YMCA shipped out equipment via the Red Cross, including bats and balls. The Olympics saw the different nations competing at football, boxing, and even chess, and offered another reflection of national character. The Poles were deadly serious, the French exuberant, the Dutch were solemn, the Belgians followed the French, and the Brits just laughed. Typically, the British cheered the worst competitors loudest and came last in every event. The inner courtyard of Colditz, dark, cramped, and cobbled, was ill-suited to any existing type of sport, and so a new one was devised. Eton created the wool game, rugby was invented at rugby, and in the strange public school atmosphere of the camp, the prisoners devised stool ball, a game of extreme violence dictated by the architecture and atmosphere of Colditz, played there and nowhere else. A cross between rugby and cage fighting, stool ball was conducted as follows. One man from each team sat on a stool at either end of the courtyard, and the opposing squads, with up to 30 players each, then competed to knock him off his perch while carrying the ball, using any means possible. Biting and kicking were not permitted. Pretty much anything else was. Padding was optional. There was a half time when everybody was too tired to continue. This was less a sport than an exercise in testosterone release. If you wanted to thump someone, then you'd play them in stool ball. The two teams fought up and down the courtyard, under the perplexed gaze of the guards, slipping and crashing over the uneven stones, and frequently sustaining fairly serious injuries. The Germans were convinced that the players were insane. In September, a fresh batch of prisoners arrived in the camp, including two who were different from any others, and would be treated in contrasting ways for entirely different reasons. One was Winston Churchill's communist nephew, and the other was Indian. Birendranath Mazumdar was a doctor, and a very good one. The son of a distinguished surgeon from the city of Gaya in northeast India, he was a Brahmin born into the high noon of the British Raj, well-educated, with elegant manners and fastidious tastes. Round-faced and soft-voiced, Mazumdar spoke English with a refined accent, as well as Bengali, Hindi, Urdu, French and German. He never smoked without gloves on. He wrote in green ink on thick azure blue notepaper. The family owned a large farm at Ranchi and a pharmacy. As a boy, his devout mother had insisted he undergo Upanayana, the Hindu sacred thread ceremony, a rite of passage requiring fasting and isolation. His more anglicised father, whose patients included officers of the British East India Company, encouraged the young Biran to read aloud from the Times every evening. The boy was educated at elite schools modelled on the British education system and brought up to observe a code of honour that was Victorian British in tone. Duty, loyalty, morality, sincerity, stick to these principles and you won't go far wrong, his father had told him. The Mazumdars had prospered under the Raj, but Biran grew up to become a committed Indian nationalist, fiercely opposed to British rule in India. I had seen in my country the superiority of the British, the oppression. He was a supporter of both Mahatma Gandhi, the leader of the Indian independence movement, and the radical nationalist, Subhas Chandra Bose. Mazumdar sounded and behaved like an Englishman, but to many Englishmen he did not look like one. Among Indians he was a figure of respect, even grandeur, an educated, high-caste Hindu from a rich family. But to the majority of white men, he was just another Indian. In 1931, he left Gaya for London, intent on becoming a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons. "To succeed, you are going to have to be 10% better than the others," he was told by the pioneering surgeon Gordon Taylor. The young Indian doctor was proud, funny, ambitious, occasionally obstreperous, solemn and conflicted, the product of two distinct, entwined, overlapping and increasingly incompatible cultures. Despite his opposition to the British Empire, when war was declared, Birendranath Mazumdar came to its defence. Some 2.5 million Indians served on the Allied side during the war, mostly as uniformed soldiers of the British Indian Army. Mazumdar, however, being resident in London and British trained, joined the British Army, which was still almost wholly white. In September 1939, he volunteered for the Royal Army Medical Corps, swore an oath of allegiance to King George VI, and was dispatched to France with the rank of captain, the only non-white officer in the corps and the only Indian officer in the British Army. He was posted to the 17th Base Hospital at Etaples as General Medical Officer. In May 1940, with German forces closing in, Mazumdar led a convoy of 40 ambulances carrying 500 wounded soldiers towards Boulogne-sur-Mer in the hope of joining the evacuation. Outside the village of Neufchâtel-en-Bray, their path was blocked by 20 panzers, which opened fire. Two of the ambulances were hit. Mazumdar helped to pull the survivors from the burning vehicles, then tied a khaki handkerchief to his baton, held it above his head, and walked towards the German tanks. The panzer commander was most polite and spoke perfect English. "I'm sorry, I'm afraid you won't reach Boulogne, and please don't try to escape." These were words Mazumdar would hear repeatedly over the coming years. The prisoners were marched 100 miles to Nijmegen on the Dutch border with Germany, and then crammed onto a flotilla of filthy coal barges with hundreds of other captives. For 2 days, they were slowly hauled down the canals into Germany, with human excrement slopping around their feet. Many of his fellow captives were infested with lice and already suffering from dysentery. Another 2-day march brought them to Kassel prison camp, where Mazumdar's belongings were confiscated, including his gold cigarette case and lighter, Parker pen and pencil, medical bag and typewriter. A German officer ordered him to have his head shaved before de-lousing. Mazumdar refused, pointing out that in Hindu culture, you only shave your head when your father or mother dies. "I am not going to shave my head under any condition." A shouting match ensued, which ended with Mazumdar being dragged off to the barber and then the solitary cells. Mazumdar was not remotely cowed by this experience, and over the following year he was in constant conflict with his German captors. He complained of inadequate medical supplies and insufficient food. He demanded fresh milk and vegetables for his patients. He pointed out that the prisoners were inadequately clothed with torn trousers and soleless boots. Tuberculosis was rife. "You are an Indian," the Germans told him. "Why should you care if a few Tommies die?" But Mazumdar was persistent, and relations with the German authorities went from bad to worse. He was shuttled from one camp to another, more than a dozen in all, a difficult customer and an anomaly. Mazumdar's attentive medical care and willingness to confront the Germans ought to have endeared him to his fellow inmates, but he was always a creature apart, treated with suspicion and occasionally outright discrimination. "I was the sole Indian in whichever camp I went to," he wrote. "All the other prisoners were English or Dutch. I had read so many books of the First World War and the camaraderie. That was absolutely missing here." When the Red Cross parcels arrived, Mazumdar was left without. They had the food, but they wouldn't share it. "These were so-called educated people. I couldn't believe my eyes." The other prisoners called him Jumbo, a nickname he detested but could not shift. This was probably a reference to Jumbo, the Victorian circus elephant that was once the star attraction at London Zoo. The prisoners may have assumed that Jumbo was an Indian elephant, and hence attached the name to the sole Indian prisoner. In fact, Jumbo was an African elephant. But in the eyes of certain white people, elephants, like Indians, were all the same. In Nazi ideology, all non-whites were subhuman, Untermenschen. But for political reasons, Indians occupied an anomalous position in the fascist racial hierarchy. They were to be tolerated, even courted, if they aided the Nazi cause. The growing nationalist movement in India posed a direct threat to British power. From the German standpoint, Mazumdar was not just an oddity, but an opportunity. Several thousand soldiers of the British Indian Army were captured during the fighting in North Africa. If these prisoners and other Indians resident in Germany could be persuaded to throw in their lot with the Nazis, that might simultaneously undermine British rule in India, boost Germany's military forces, and deliver an important propaganda victory. Mazumdar had made no secret of his nationalist sympathies, and so the Germans set about trying to persuade the only Indian officer in the British Army to switch sides. Soon after arriving in Kassel camp, Mazumdar was summoned to the commandant's office, where a completely bald German officer and a young Indian man were waiting. The German came straight to the point and asked Mazumdar to make a radio broadcast encouraging other Indians to join a new military unit to fight the British and hasten the end of the Raj. "You can have a good life if you join us and join your countrymen." The fascist William Joyce, known as Lord Haw-Haw, was already making regular broadcasts to Britain from Berlin, predicting Nazi victory and calling on Britons to surrender. This well-spoken Indian might fulfil a similar role in India by urging his fellow countrymen to rise up against the British. Mazumdar flatly refused. "I cannot do it." Now the young Indian chimed in. On the desk he spread out photographs of bomb-damaged London. "The war is virtually over," he said. "Germany has won the war, and it is foolish for you to undergo the hardships of a POW camp when you could be living in comfort and freedom. You only have to agree to broadcast for the Germans." Again, Mazumdar refused and was marched out of the commandant's office. In the summer of 1941, at Marienburg camp, he was interviewed by a young German officer. "Have you changed your mind?" he asked. "Will you speak on the wireless?" Mazumdar again declined. "Will you at least go to Berlin?" Mazumdar shook his head. "Well, you're going anyway." Mazumdar replied archly that if he was forced to travel, as an officer he should have an orderly to carry his suitcase. Forced at the point of two revolvers to carry my own luggage, he was marched onto a train and taken to an office block in Berlin, where the officer was waiting with another more senior. "Have you changed your mind about making a broadcast?" "No, and what is more, you are ascribing to me an importance that I do not possess and do not even claim." The officer changed tack. "When were you last with a woman?" Mazumdar was outraged. "If you think my honour can be bought with a woman, you are very wrong." Now the other man spoke up. "This man is deutschfeindlich." "Well, you're the best judge of that," snapped Mazumdar. Back at the camp, an irate German officer ranted at him. "You have troubled us and bothered us wherever you have been. You are a traitor to your country." When Mazumdar opened his mouth to protest, the officer punched him in the face. The red tab denoting an anti-German attitude was added to his file, and Mazumdar was on his way to Colditz. The Indian doctor arrived on the 26th of September in the middle of the night, the castle rearing up above him bathed in searchlights, a vision that would fit naturally in the pages of a Bram Stoker novel. He turned to the sentry and asked in German, "Where am I?" The man simply put his finger to his lips. Birendranath Mazumdar was taken to an empty room and locked inside. "I didn't know where I was. All I heard was the click of the key as the door shut. I was, to say the least, miserable and lost." A few days earlier, another singular prisoner, a short, dark-haired man in his mid-twenties, had been brought to the castle by car, escorted by two German officers. Giles Romilly was a civilian, a journalist and a communist, who had been captured while covering the disastrous Norway campaign for the Daily Express. Romilly was confined to Colditz for one reason only. His mother was the younger sister of Clementine Churchill, Winston Churchill's wife. In German eyes, this family connection made him a prisoner of special significance and a potentially valuable asset. Had he not been Churchill's nephew, Romilly would almost certainly have been repatriated to Britain. Instead, he was retained as a useful pawn, less a prisoner than a hostage, who could be swapped, held for ransom, or used to extract concessions from Britain's Prime Minister. This calculation was based on a false premise. Churchill barely knew Romilly, whom he referred to vaguely as Nelly's boy, and what he did know was unlikely to endear his nephew to him. Giles and his equally rebellious brother Esmond had distributed communist leaflets while schoolboys at Wellington and set up a radical newspaper to champion the forces of progress against the forces of reaction on every front. Giles declared himself a pacifist and refused to join the officer training corps. In 1934, the Daily Mail published an article about the communist Romilly brothers under the headline "Red Menace in Public Schools, Moscow Attempts to Corrupt Boys." Giles reported from Spain during the Civil War, while his brother fought for the international brigades against Franco's nationalists. In 1937, the Soviet intelligence officer Walter Kravitsky defected to Britain and revealed to MI5 that the Soviets had recruited a young British aristocrat as a spy. Kravitsky could not recall the man's name, but knew he had been sent to Spain by his Russian spy masters under the cover of journalism with orders to assassinate General Franco. The British Security Service became convinced that this public school-educated communist would-be assassin must be Giles Romilly and placed him under surveillance. MI5's hunch was wrong. The man recruited by Soviet intelligence was Kim Philby, who would go on to become the most infamous spy in British history. Romilly was a communist renegade, a suspected Soviet agent, and an embarrassment to his aristocratic family. But even if he had been none of those things, Winston Churchill would never have attached special value to a prisoner just because he happened to be a relative by marriage. The Prime Minister was far too politically astute for such favouritism. The Germans did not understand this and remained convinced that certain high-born or well-connected prisoners were of greater worth than others and should therefore be more closely guarded. Romilly was the first of what the Germans came to refer to as the prominente, the prominent ones, individuals who, by virtue of birth or social standing, were gathered in Colditz and held under the tightest security. The Nazis regarded these VIP prisoners as a kidnapper treats a captive, objects of value to be traded or ransomed, carefully safeguarded and, if no longer useful, dispensed with. They were the trump cards of the POW population, and on no account could they be allowed to escape. The other prisoners observed Romilly's arrival, a man with a boyish face and light blue eyes, as unlike his illustrious uncle as one could get. He was locked in a cell at the end of a long stone passage on the opposite side of the courtyard from the British quarters. "The sensation of enclosure was overpowering," he wrote. Down in the courtyard, a motley collection of people were shuffling round the cobbles like figures in Van Gogh's asylum drawing. The window was barred, the outside frame painted white so that the guards could immediately identify which one contained the most prized prisoner in Colditz. He was kept under 24-hour surveillance. Though Romilly was allowed to mix with other prisoners during the day, his whereabouts were checked and noted every hour, and he was locked away at night, with a sentry permanently stationed in the corridor and changed every 2 hours. The guards watched him through a spy hole in the door. He was not permitted to leave the inner courtyard for the park walk. "These precautions from the start seemed ominous," he wrote. These extreme security measures were motivated by fear. The orders from the Wehrmacht High Command were explicit. Commandant and security officer answer for Rommel's security with their heads and should take any and every exceptional measure to ensure he did not escape. Eggers believed this command had come from Hitler himself. Rommel was an additional security headache, and one which posed a direct threat to the jailers themselves. A photo of Rommel was posted in the guardroom, and every guard was expected to familiarise himself with his appearance. The sentries lived in fear that he might escape on their watch, and so two or three times a night the guard would enter his cell to pull back the blanket and check he had not magically vanished. A prized specimen in his own customised cage, Rommel was the only Colditz prisoner to merit his own code name, Emil. The guard on duty outside his door was known as an Emil Beobachter, an Emil Watcher. Initially, Rommel reacted with fury to this unique form of incarceration, hurling his boots at the door and pasting paper over the spy hole. But gradually he adapted. He received better food than the other inmates and was allowed his own gramophone. At night, the sound of Mozart's Haffner Symphony could be heard wafting from his cell, as a small, lonely figure in an old dressing gown gazed out from behind the bars. Padre Platt noted Romilly's changing demeanour as the months passed. There is a restless look in his eyes, and a droop of discontent at the corners of his mouth. Rommel enjoyed a more comfortable existence than other inmates, but it was also, he reflected, a privileged nightmare. The founder member of an elite club, he would eventually be joined by other prominente, accorded an exclusive form of incarceration because, as Rommel put it, they had been singled out as specially special. They were also uniquely vulnerable, protected for only as long as they remained valuable. These men were bargaining chips, and at some point they would be cashed in.